Hi, this is Martin Fowler, and you're listening to The Agile Uprising.
Hello, and welcome to another edition of the Agile Uprising podcast. I'm Brad Stokes, and with me today, Jay and Troy. Say good day, guys.
Hello.
Hello.
We're having a bit of a discussion about fear and all sorts of different things on the Slacks. And one of the questions I had was, I was actually reflecting on failure and learning and how we can't even get into failure and learning if we can't get past our fears of actually moving forward. So I asked the question to basically everybody is, what keeps you from moving forward? Or what are the things that you've had hold you back fear-wise? And how did you actually move forward through that? And I guess we can just go from there. So what are some of the things that actually scare you?
Okay. Jay, you want to kick us off?
No, I talked all over you last episode. You get to go first.
Okay, I'll go first. So we can talk about this from a couple perspectives. As a coach, kind of what are we afraid of when it comes to our clients? You know, what are our hopes that we see them successful at versus, you know, what are we afraid that if it's something that continues that from our perspective, we think it'll fail. And then also personal. So I think I can address it from that topic. So one, as a coach, I just hope that the clients that I and other coaches like me who consult particularly, but even full-time coaches, of course, but consultants that we're there for a brief amount of time in the company's history. And we try to make an impact. And obviously, we try to make it positive. And the fear is that when we leave, things will just go back to the way they were, or potentially even be worse for some reason, right? So that's what you do not want, okay? So you want to leave it in a better place than you came. And for me, what does better look like? Well, it really depends on what the client's needs are. But the number one thing that I hope when I leave a place is that the people that work there feel like their work life is better than when they left it. So that might sound weird to some people, but at the end of the day, I really feel like Agile itself is all about, at its core, about the people. And it recognizes that people are the one who are doing the work and therefore they're the most important. So individuals and interactions, right? The way that people are and the way they communicate and collaborate. So bringing the fun into Agile. So my fear would be people look at Agile as a purely process thing. Which is used to, it's just another way of using a measuring stick or some kind of whip, right, to beat people into submission a new way. And that's my biggest fear because I've seen it happen. And when Agile is used that way, it can be like worse than what, the way it was before. So one of the things that I try to look out for as a coach is, If there's a patterns of these things popping up, I try to address it right away, you know, and say, no, this isn't the way. But the number one thing I typically see is metrics. So people tend to use metrics as a way to, they don't mean to do it intentionally, but people end up hating their job or hating Agile because of the way metrics are used sometimes.
You know? So Troy, your first statement, you said one of your fears when you work with a client is that you're going to leave and things are going to go back to the way they were, if not worse.
Yes.
How do you get around that? Like, what do you do to help? I know it's almost a wing and a prayer sort of stuff, but what do you do to help prevent that from happening or plant? What seeds do you plant to hope that when you leave, it doesn't go back to the way it was, if not 10 times worse, which is honestly what we see a lot.
Well, I really think from my style, it's really about the people side of things. So if people can see when I leave that, hey, this thing that we're doing here, this Agile thing, right? It's not so much about stand-ups and retrospect. It's not so much about process. It's more about us collaborating and that we're getting better results because we're working together and we're able to be more creative and we have ownership of our own work and kind of our own quality instead of just being like taskmasters, you know? If I walk away and people feel like that genuinely, then I feel like I'll leave it at a better place, because no matter what, once people get that feeling and once people get that way of working, usually one of two things happens. If the place goes back to the way it was, they either will kind of revolt or just not accept it, or they'll leave and go somewhere else. So I've seen both of those things happen. Usually people won't stick around once they've had a taste of what it feels like to work in a collaborative kind of fun environment where you're seen as someone, where you're valued for your individual contributions as not just someone who can do the work, but someone who's involved in creating the solution too, you know? So that's what I work towards. Every time I go in there, that's what I'm looking to accomplish.
I guess I'll go next. So I think the biggest fear for me, and keep in mind that I'm coming as a full-time employee, right? Mm-hmm. In a company that's going through a large enterprise transformation. Mm-hmm. We're trying to change how we work and go to an agile way of working. I think my biggest fear in that context is somebody somewhere is going to get impatient and say that we've spent this money and we don't see the results that we thought we were going to get, and they pull the plug. And speaking to you, Troy, and other people that we've crossed paths with, I know that's a valid concern for a lot of people. Like, what if my company decides that this is no longer worth it and we're going to do something else? Or even more terrifying, what if my company thinks that where we are now is fit for purpose and I can move away from that? And I don't need to make any more improvement. That's terrifying as well. To me, I think that's the biggest thing that keeps me up at night. Is somebody, some bean counter somewhere is going to say we've spent X and we don't have Y to show for it, so we need to kibosh this and go to something else.
So how does that affect your behavior?
Well, it's one of those things where you worry about it, but I'm not sure how much you can actually do about it because you don't. It's really outside of my sphere of control. But I think what I try to do to mitigate that is you concentrate on the change that we have realized thus far and consistently celebrate the wins that we've gotten, because some of them may not be bigger, they may not be glamorous, but they actually are they are proof of progress towards the greater goal. So for example, we've had a bunch of people stand up, we've had a bunch of teams stand up, and we've had a bunch of new Scrum Masters come from the company. So we have had a couple of people come from outside, but we've had people who internally they've said they want to be Scrum Masters. We've trained them up and we've stuck them in their roles. And I've started to hear a lot more from a lot of them who are really, they get the concept. They don't play it lip service. Like, we've all come across people in transformations who pay it lip service, right? They don't really get it. But there's a lot of young people who are like, to your point, Troy, you know, I want to work this way. I don't want to go back. They're starting to get hungry for it. So for me, it's making sure there's some consistency there, that they're all trying to do the same thing at the right way, you know, like not out of like a command and control type thing, but knowing that the message that's out in the zeitgeist, everybody's saying the same thing. I think that's a big help. It's like Cotter says, celebrate your wins, celebrate them early and often, and mm-hmm. keep them in the front of your mind. I'm always the one, and I'm not just the only one. There's a bunch of people. I'm in a big company. There's a bunch of people. We're always talking about the things that we've done right. And even when we bring up something that we need to do better, it's pitched under the auspices of, okay, well, we took this step and it wasn't perfect, but it was a step. Now let's iterate on it and get better at it. So for me, it really just becomes, I hate to be like the broken record, but I try to always emphasize the positives, right? Because if given the chance, you know, naturally some people will get negative and cynical and go off into the woods. So that's a part of it. As far as controlling the narrative, I do try to do that as well, as much as I can in my lowly position, is control the narrative that's going upwards. Like, look, yeah, you know, our portfolio epics are a soup sandwich. Okay. But we've got a whole bunch of them. And we have people looking at them and they're paying attention now and they want to author them to get better, because we've had the people downstream complaining that the definition of done isn't there. So take the good with the bad. That's one of my fears, is that, you know, it's a summarize it, is somebody fails to see the benefit of what we've delivered thus far and wants to prematurely end the experiment. I guess that's probably a good way to put it. How about you, Brad?
I always have that wonderful fear of, am I actually providing the right level of detail. Am I giving too much? Am I giving not enough? And, you know, the impacts of what I suggest, and I go with suggestions as opposed to thou must do, they have long-term impacts on the team that I'm dealing with, and I might not be there to see that out. So I mean, my fear is, you know, that the information I'm giving or the thing that I'm suggesting is not the right thing. And it's that wonderful imposter syndrome, which I know that we all get. And it doesn't stop me from actually making the suggestions. But, you know, part of that is having a good backup, having the right people around you to be able to bounce ideas off. And it's not just all in your own head, but also trusting that you're going to make the best decision you can at the time. And hopefully it works, and being able to respond to that. But I guess that's one of mine, is just, am I suggesting the right things? Am I actually helping? And you can see it, but every now and then you've just got that little wiggle room of doubt.
So how do you fight that doubt? Is it bouncing it off somebody else of equal stature? Is it, do you just tell yourself, shut up, don't worry about it, you're fine? Or...
It's looking at the conditions of the system that I'm working in. If the system conditions look like they have improved, that people within that team are happy, that stuff's getting actually done and completed, I'm judging that normally that, you know, something's going right and I'm not completely wrong. The other one is I've got good mentors and good coaches around me that I can ask. And it's just like, this is what I'm seeing. This is what I'm feeling. What am I missing? Where am I going? And having that abundance of good support. You know, it's that classic, you are the people that you hang around. It's my coaching and my working with teams is I am better for the people that I have around me, which gives me faith in myself that I'm moving in the right direction. I think that makes a big difference. Because part of this whole discussion from me was we talk about failure being one of those things that we should seek out. And I've never really liked it. I've always liked that learning rather than look for the failure, look for the learning instead. And often part of the learning is a failure somewhere along the way. But if you're not recognizing the learnings, you're not seeing where you've got the gaps and not having those people around you, that accountability around you, it's really hard to get that. And, you know, it's the questions that you ask yourself as much as anything else.
Troy, imposter syndrome, does that ever pop into your head?
So every single person that you meet knows something that you don't.
Mm-hmm.
So it's impossible to know everything that that person knows, because everybody in the world has some piece of knowledge that you probably don't have, right? So that's just I think that's probably true technically, but it's also the mindset I just go in with. So I look at it as a learning opportunity. And one of the great things about being a consultant is you have so many opportunities to learn from so many different people. So it's like they learn from you. Yes, obviously, because you're taking your own experiences plus things that you learn on your own, plus things that you're learning at other client sites and bringing it to every client you go to, which is a huge benefit for any client because they're getting that total experience plus knowledge from all these sources. But at the same time, there are going to be things that every single client I'm going to learn from, because everybody's different and they all have different needs and different ways they do things. I think you can take that imposter syndrome stuff, and which for some people can maybe be cause anxiety or be debilitating, and really flip it and say, no, this is really a positive. This is an opportunity for me to just learn and take this and help other people. And because if you're a coach, essentially that's what you're in it for. So I would say take that. Once you come across something that you don't know that someone's talking about, don't look at it as a negative for yourself. Look at it as a positive, like, oh, I'm going to learn everything about this that I can. So therefore it'll just make me stronger.
So part of it really is that almost giving yourself permission to not know.
Yeah, exactly.
To not understand.
I had a coworker say to me, a young guy, much younger than me by 20 years at least, and he made the remark that if you walk into the room and you're the smartest person in the room, you're in the wrong room. And he's right, because I have found my imposter syndrome, my fear of that, kicks in not when I'm in a room of people who I know I'm intellectually outmatched by, because I look at that as now I can learn, right? So right. I write down everything that they bring up that I have no clue what they're talking about because I want to learn.
Right.
I find the only time that imposter syndrome can actually get in my way is when I walk in the room and I'm looked at as the expert. And in the back of my mind, I have that lingering fear that what if I say something that proves I'm a sham and I'm not really, I don't know as much as they all think I know. And what if I ruin their preconceived notion? And that's where I find myself, I just keep talking. And I talk so much that I shut that voice in the back of my head out.
Right.
But that's where I've noticed for me, it really kicks in. It's not that I don't have confidence. It's just that I guess I don't look at myself as an expert, right? Because I don't look in the mirror and see that. So when people look at me as, I kind of sort of worry that I'm going to disappoint somebody, I guess. Maybe that's another fear I'm slowly talking myself through as this episode goes on.
Yeah, it makes sense. Brad, what are your thoughts about imposter syndrome?
I think everybody has it. I think anybody that doesn't have it is probably has some form of psychiatric disorder.
Shout out to John Ronson.
Narcissists themselves. I'm the best person in the room. No, I haven't met a programmer yet, a good programmer yet, that doesn't have it to at least some degree. It, in some cases, drives you to go forward, but if you let it stop you, you've missed the point. I admit, I get that same fear. Is that I go into a room where people are looking to me to have all the answers. I don't have all the answers, and I know I don't have all the answers. So, you know, it's. But, you know, most times the people in the room actually do have those answers. They're there. It's sometimes half the trick is getting them to draw it out themselves.
Yeah, I think that's a great point, Brad, is that there's a term called wisdom of the whole. So it's like the wisdom of the whole group is going to be more than one person, usually. So even if I walk in a room as a coach I think there's a different perception of being a consultant versus a coach, and then maybe that's a whole podcast on its own. But even as a consultant, I try to be a coach most of the time. And that's really about kind of bringing out the wisdom that the people I'm coaching already have, you know, and not so much about what I think, and more about trying to get to the best solutions that they can create themselves, but helping facilitate that conversation, right? So that's like, if I just come in there and say, I know everything, I know all the answers, I might be able to provide some answers, but that in no way is going to be necessarily the best solution, right? Yeah. So being open to that and going into the room and saying, okay, well, here's my experience, and I can share that with you. Here's what I've done. Here's what I've seen work at other places. But you guys are different, so let's come up with some solutions together.
Yeah.
And using those, we talked about it earlier, double diamond, like the concept of divergent and convergent thinking, right? Brainstorming, these types of things, right? So using those techniques and really coming up with great ideas, but respecting the whole, knowing that as a group, we're going to be more wise than me as a coach or any one individual. So that's the approach I try to go with. Yeah.
My thing's always been, I'm ready to be wrong. I'm always ready to be wrong because I know I don't have best information. And sometimes I've got a few tricks, best way to call them. User story mapping. It's such a simple concept, but so few people have actually done it. But it can just reveal so much. But it's a trick. It's a really simple thing. It's playing with bits of paper to visualize something.
Right.
A lot of the stuff that we do is like that. It's not particularly complex. It's not hard. It's just, if you don't know it exists, sometimes it can help them draw their own conclusions. So it's sometimes just having some of those tools up the belt as well can kind of help. But you can't get to that unless you've actually listened to the group and saying, look, these are our deficits.
Right.
And if they really have no idea about where the next little thing to do is, you can't fix everything, but you can find your little edges that help them get that half step forward, I guess. And sometimes it's, oh God, can I even get to that point? Worries me.
Okay. So maybe we can go into some other, we're talking about fears, right? So Jay, you were talking about in our board meeting a quote that I gave when I was kind of quoting someone else, but I don't know how that's possible if I've never read their work, but it's just, maybe it's coincidence. I don't know.
Okay. No, it's definitely synchronicity. It's
okay. But that quote, and for those who aren't familiar, it's really talking about hypothesis-driven development decision-making. And a lot of times in history, and this is how I'm applying things I'm learning about history to my work. So one of the things I love doing is bringing non-Agile things into Agile. It's like a
big, yes, like a, yes, I love it. We're all nodding. Yeah.
So that's why I love latching on to things like the spiral dynamic stuff and the Cantor four player model and all these things, which are not like Agile 101 stuff, you know, Scrum stuff, but that can be very applicable to our work. So another one is, you know, in the past 13, 14 months now, I've been very passionate about finding out about health and I have my own blog and website and these types of things, right? So a lot of my, aside from my personal kind of transformation, a lot of my work, and I'm going to call it work because it really has been like a side job for me, is like reading tons of books and nutritional studies and really, if I get into something, I just like super geek out about it and I have to know like everything about it. I'm the type of person that you can't just, if someone tells me, Troy, do this and it'll work, I might try it, but I immediately have to find out why it's working, if it's working. Like, I can't just accept the fact that this works, right? So that's like how I get into that. That kind of drove me down a huge rabbit hole about the history of nutritional science around the world, actually. And a lot of my thoughts about hypothesis-driven decision-making, and particularly which I've been applying to a portfolio level, for instance, at a recent client, you know, we've been standing up a portfolio management team and a portfolio Kanban, and we've been using a lot of these epic initiatives, SAFE, which are basically just like hypothesis, you know, ideas that you have, right? And that you try to prove out, or you have some leading indicators and things like that. So one of the things I'm trying to bring to it is, I see a lot of, and at a previous client, I can give an example, a mistake I've seen, people tend to write metrics and leading indicators to prove out their point. And if you create leading indicators and metrics to prove a point, you will probably prove it, right? And that doesn't mean that you're right, actually. That's a very unscientific way of going about things. So what are the things that, go ahead, Brad.
I was just going to say, it just plays straight into the confirmation bias type stuff.
Yep. So if you, and I'm not going to get into it on this podcast, but essentially, if you look at the history of how we got our current modern nutritional science, it comes from a lot of associative epidemiological studies, which were basically, the way these things are funded is you get funding by having a hypothesis and then going to, and people are kind of giving you a grant, and essentially you're kind of, if you don't prove that your hypothesis is true, it's looked at as like a waste of money and a negative. So it lends itself to this confirmation bias. So the more I've learned about that, the more I've seen, oh, like this is real science. This is not actually science. This is just confirmation bias. Like, and you can kind of start to, it's almost like the Matrix. You can kind of start to see the code, you know? So it's like, oh, okay. So every time there's like a new study, like somebody tweets, I'm like, oh, I can see the code. I can see the, this is real science. This is junk. Like I can see. And what's funny is like even people that agree with me about certain things, I see them tweet all the time, junk science. And I'm like, guys and girls, just because something agrees with the way you think doesn't mean it's valid. You know, it's like, You can't just go with what you think is true. You always have to look at what is the real evidence telling us, and how do we set ourselves up to try to disprove what we're saying, right? what is the evidence that's disproving what we're saying, and compare that to what's proving it and try to make a valid assumption. So there's a,
it sounds to me, Troy, that almost your fear, right? Underlying fear is that people will get so wrapped up in work and personal, whatever, they get so wrapped up in proving themselves right. Right. And saying that, no, what I know is what I know. And they end up with, they lack intellectual curiosity. And as a result of that, people do dumb things and make bad decisions based on them confirming a bad idea. I feel almost the same way about PowerPoint, right?
Well, so two things on that, Jay. So number one is, let's say I'm a product manager or a product owner or somebody that's in product, right? Whatever the title is. I come up with an epic hypothesis idea, right? Let's say that I come up with this idea, we go build a part of it out, and it's proofs, and the numbers just don't show that it's a valid idea, right? But let's say I'm in an organization who people get rewarded for having good ideas, right? Or so, like, let's say that failure, people might perceive that as a failure because your idea was proven not to be a good one. So there might be this total, like, this bias. And now, next time I come up with an idea, you know, I might not listen to Troy's idea. I might not consider it a prioritization, right? Because his ideas are usually incorrect, right? And that's actually the opposite of what we should be going for, right? So a lot of this is related to reward systems, and not just monetarily, but how people relate to each other. And I think that also applies not only in our work, but also in life and other areas. So I'm seeing, you know, I've learned and I've seen that in other types of scientific ways of working. So like when, particularly nutritional science. So my biggest fear is, I guess it's two parts of this, multiple biggest fears, right? So for I'm going to wrap this all up and say that I'm going to call confirmation bias junk science. I'm going to be very, very matter of fact about this. Essentially, it's going to not only really hinder our performance at work and waste the companies that we work at a lot of money, okay, and potentially put them at risk because for many reasons, risk meaning waste of, you know, essentially waste of money and time, right? Or great ideas might not be coming out because people are afraid to come up with a hypothesis, you know, for things like that. So they will come up with numbers which will prove themselves out. And I think history could repeat itself in other forms of science that we have seen that I'm talking about. And the effects of that type of science are far worse. Because if you're making recommendations on everyone on the planet should be doing these things, regardless of what it is, right? So if you're talking about diet or exercise or different types of work. So for instance, nutrition, if you're going to make nutritional recommendations based off of science, but if that science is not really rock solid, or if it's using some of these confirmation bias things, or if it's using some of these we're going to use metrics that are going to prove our point because that's what we're just gung-ho on doing, right? Because we want to be successful. Then it's just flat out dangerous. So my biggest fear is that science, regardless of whether it's in nutritional field, whether that's in at work or even if you want to just tie it back to SAFE, for example, because SAFE is really taking off and it's very successful in our field. And part of SAFE, which is a great part, is this hypothesis-driven initiative, which is awesome. But I feel like my big fear is that we won't learn from mistakes in the past from other parts of life, and we'll be very agile about this thing and not see overlap. And so for me, that's something that I'm trying to bring into my career and work, is bringing in overlap from other areas of science into this agile space and learning from the past, you know? So there you go. That's,
no, I get it. I've actually been thinking a bit about the idea of vicarious agile. Again, completely unrelated. I was listening to another podcast called Hidden Brain, and it happens to be pretty good. And they were talking about our ability to watch something being done and think that we're doing it ourselves, or watch something done and think that we'll be competent the first time that we do it. So we can live vicariously through other people's experience. And I actually worry about teams where you're seeing some one team within an organization actually performing pretty well, but the teams around them looking at them and actually, oh, it's not hard. We're doing the same things. They're living their agile vicariously rather than looking at the heart underneath it. Hmm. So it might be because I've seen it done well, ergo I'm doing it well and I can do it well. As you know, I worry about that. I worry about that from my own practice, but it's also from those teams that you work with that it's like they're seeing it done well somewhere and they're just thinking, oh, this is easier than what it is. And they're not mm-hmm. questioning what it is that they're actually doing. So there's no critical thought that's going into that. I mean, I lack of critical thought scares me immensely. Lack of ability to say, look, let's look for success metrics, but hey, let's go the other scale. Let's look at where it doesn't work as well and define those up front so that when we're questioning this thing later, we actually have some gauge rather than let's just look for the happy clappies.
You took that in a different way, Brad. I couldn't tell where you were going when you said vicarious agile, but then you made that statement and that I think that hits home, right? You sitting on a table, like for example, and you're doing agile and you're doing it well, right? You're hitting all the right notes and Troy and I are sitting over here on the other side of the room and we're watching you and we're going, oh, that's easy. You know, whatever, Brad's doing it. We can make that work. That's easy. And I couldn't tell where you were going with that, but now I get it. You're right. There is that potential of other parts of the org to say, they did it. Whatever. We'll be fine. No big deal. It's easy. Yeah. It's not.
But it can also be from our own practice. You know, we're looking at somebody else who've done, you know, value stream maps. Value stream maps are awesome. I love them. But they're actually harder than they look to put together. So it's you know, I can talk to Karen Martin or I can read the book and I can attempt it. But, you know, just because I've talked to Karen Martin and read the book doesn't mean I can do it. So, you know, there's that fear of overconfidence there. Mm. Yeah, I read all the flipping time. I think we all do. But that doesn't mean that I have the backup for it.
Yeah.
And knowing that something. So there can be that vicariousness as well. So there's that aspect.
That's interesting. That's interesting. So I've got a good one, but I want to touch on, Troy, you talked about you love using history to give mm-hmm. examples of Agile. I think the world's first failed Agile transformation was for Fordlandia down in South America. Read into that. That's pretty interesting.
Okay.
And regarding your whole thing about junk science and confirmation bias and non-hypothesis-based testing, look into the history of the CIA and how conspiracy theory works. And how that was introduced in the 50s and 60s, as everybody's looking at their radio going, Jesus Christ, Jay, put on the tinfoil hat. there's some interesting history there. So when we talk about fears, one of the biggest fears I have, and it's agile, but it's not agile, right? One of the biggest tragedies in life is either unfulfilled potential or unrecognized mm-hmm. genius. And that's not necessarily to say I'm a genius, but I'm always worried that I'm not going to reach the potential that I'm possible of. And more importantly, I come across people, we have an early technologist program at my job, and I come across people who I really truly do think have amazing potential. I really do. And there is a part of me that even though they're not my direct report and they're just someone I work with, you know, through the course of the way things work, I always do keep it in the back of my mind that it would be a shame if people don't realize how smart Brad really is. And it would be a shame if Brad doesn't get a chance to really grow because I think he's actually smarter than me and I think he could do well. And to mitigate that, I do my part to, you know, sing people's praises and, you know, when they do something smart, tell them that's great. You want that. You want more of that. But it is always a fear that, you know, there's nothing sadder than someone who flames out, right? Or someone who had the ability to be brilliant and they just never recognize it. And that, you know, your corporate culture can actually kill that. And that's one of those things where you really are a salmon swimming upstream. But that's almost terrifying. I think I know what I can do in my own career. I would hope that someone eventually recognizes it and pays me strappingly for it. But I do have concerns about some of the coworkers I work with that maybe their manager isn't great. Or maybe they don't get recognized for the work they can do. And I don't mean to sound like I'm this wonderful benevolent altruist, but it does concern me because I think there are people who really deserve to get their fair shake and there's no way to guarantee that they do. Yep. It's probably a little bit weirder than we wanted to go on this podcast, but
that's fine.
I don't think we had a particular direction, so this kind of is pretty interesting. So we're coming up on our time.
Okay.
How would you like to close out? What would be your big tip for actually, recognizing fear? Because I always say, and I say it about almost anything, if you can't see it, you can't fix it. You can't even start. How do you actually start to recognize your fears or the fears of those around you and then start doing something about it?
I think you start by talking about it. Right? Like even this step alone, I think if there's something right around your brain, you actually said it, Brad, the first step is to find someone who you can confide in or find someone you can talk to and actually verbalize it. Bring it, make it real by projecting it outwards with your voice. And then from there, I think that's then you may not have a solution, but at least then you've acknowledged it and then you could help, deal with it and help mitigate it as opposed to just, burying it and forcing it down deep inside. If you don't mind me giving me a personal example, my mom passed away right after I graduated college. So I did my graduation ceremony in May. She passed away in August and I started my first real job, white collar job. I think it was right after Labor Day weekend. Right. So, in hindsight, I pushed all those feelings down. And I kept pushing them down, the remorse and the sadness. And I just kept trying to push it down into a deeper part of me. I didn't want to acknowledge it because I was busy with my new job. I was busy worrying about my dad. I was busy worrying about my brother. And in hindsight, I look and I was really depressed and I was not myself. Like I was, when I look back, I don't even like pictures from that time. I didn't even recognize myself because I wasn't myself. And I think maybe I should have had a shrink to talk to, or maybe I should have just said to somebody, maybe this is bothering me. If I had acknowledged it and I guess the reason I bring it up is that went on for a good 9 months, almost a year. And I think in hindsight, if I had found someone to confide in or talk to, not that there weren't people there, I just never thought to do it. It would have ameliorated it much quicker because I would have brought it out and said, this is bothering me. And maybe through some way the world works, I would have found a support system to help me get it through quicker, I guess.
Yeah.
It took me a long time to get to that self-reflection point where I could look back and say, Jesus, I don't ever want to do that again. And now I swing the other way and I have no filter and I leave nothing unsaid. And it's probably even worse. But I guess that's my advice now that Jay got on a soapbox. Just verbalize it and find someone to talk to. And that's the best way to mitigate it.
I got nothing else, Jay. That was excellent. That's very good.
Shit, I'm sorry, Troy. I didn't mean to get out of the room either.
But no, that was good. That was good.
I think that's the best advice I would give anybody. It's just bring it out into the world and make it so. Because if you make it so, then you can deal with it.
I know there are some good resources out there. Andy Clef does a fear and fear and vulnerability retro that he's got for teams. That's excellent. I haven't had a chance to use it, but I'm still looking for the opportunity because it's great. It really is that. I think you're right. I think it's being able to bring something to light, bring a thought to light and realize it for what it was. And sometimes those fears are unfounded. Sometimes those fears are just absolutely hubris where you're pumping yourself up, making yourself much bigger in the story than what you actually are. I've done that one a few times. I've certainly run that, but that's really good. As I said, I think we're about on time. So I'd say on behalf of all of us here, Jay, Troy, myself, we'd like to give you thanks for just spending the episode with us. We'd love to catch up with you on the Coalition, which is coalition.agileuprising.com. And we do have a Patreon. If you want to support the podcast, you can join us on that. The notes will be in the show notes. Until next time, this is the Agile Uprising podcast, signing out.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you, Brad.
Thank you. How'd that go?